Okay.
Rehearsal.
So, Mike, can you start by telling us your full name, your date of birth, and where you were born, please?
Okay. Michael Derriaz was born in October 1958 in Liverpool, and I left the school in 1977.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and then just follow on with any memories from Blue Coat.
What were your main
impressions? Well, yeah, it was. I think the school was in transition because Peter Arnold Craft had become the headmaster in 1968, and this was a time when Liverpool's schools had gone just switched over from the grammar school secondary modern system to comprehensive education. So the traditional grammar schools in the city, like Liverpool Institute, Quarry Bank High School, they had all gone comprehensive. And I think this left a bit of a gap in the market for people wanting a sort of grammar school style education. So that's what, when Arnold Craft arrived, he was going to change the school into more of an academic school. And I came along, I joined the school 2 years after he'd started at the school. So it was still in development, you would say, as an academically oriented school. So one of my first memories is that the older boys in the school seemed very rough. They were quite aggressive and not very academically inclined. So we had, for example, sixth formers and prefects who were not probably going to university, and we're used to running the school by punching and kicking the younger boys, you know. and those of us in the lower forms, we were the ones who were supposed to get lots and lots of O-levels and do very well, you know. But these older boys weren't quite the same, you know, weren't in the same mould, really, as we were.
So did the atmosphere then change over the years as that sort of older group phased out and left?
Yes, it gradually became much more that the whole aim of the school was to do your exams, to do very well, and to go to university, and if possible, to a good university or to be a doctor or something like that, you know.
And I guess your parents were ambitious for you, and you yourself expected to go to university, is that correct?
Yeah, I was one of the only people in my class, I think, whose parents had themselves been to university, because my mother was a teacher and my father was a scientist. But that was very, very unusual generally at the time, I think, because in the previous generation, very few people, very few parents had university education.
Yeah.
So for a lot of the parents, it was this is the big chance to send our son to university. My parents were a bit more maybe just relaxed about it. They said, well, I suppose you will. You know, I think they thought, you know, that it was a natural thing to do, you know.
So you went to university, I take it. Is that correct?
Yeah. I went to Oxford.
You went to Oxford. What did you read?
I read English literature, which was what I really wanted to do, and I loved it. It was very good.
And did you go into an academic career? What has been your career?
No, after that, it was a somewhat unusual choice. I joined the civil service as a tax inspector when I graduated from Oxford, and from that I learned all about tax, and then I became a tax consultant with Ernst & Young, one of the biggest accountancy firms. And from there, I was offered a job by one of my clients. I became the head of the tax department at BNP Paribas, which was the largest bank in Europe at the time. So I ended up working for an investment bank as a head of department in an investment bank.
So where do you live now?
I live in Richmond in Surrey.
Right.
But I quit the investment banking world about 7 years ago to set up a charity, and this is also part of the Blue Coat story in a way, because when I left the school, I didn't go straight to university. I wanted to have a gap year, so I took myself off to Kenya. I found there was an opportunity to go to Kenya and teach in a school in Kenya. So a few weeks after I'd been a pupil at Blue Coat, I was a teacher in a school in Kenya, and I stayed there for 12 months. And so the charity that I set up five or 10 years ago is oriented to helping people in that particular region of Kenya where I was working.
That's marvellous. So if we could go back to Blue Coat, you say that Peter Arnold Craft was a reformatory head teacher.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit more about him and the impact that he had on you and the school?
Well, he was strict, but he was also ferociously intelligent, and he set very high and demanding standards, both in terms of discipline and in terms of academic performance. And I think possibly the teachers felt this as much as we did, because I believe that he kicked out a lot of the teachers, or tried to kick out a lot of the teachers when he arrived. Of course, it's quite difficult to remove a teacher then and now, you know, but he just said to some of them, well, I don't think you're going to fit, sort of thing. A lot of them left, and he recruited young, keen people who would sort of do the sort of things he wanted to do. And he made it clear that we were there to work and do well, and he wasn't going to tolerate any nonsense. And, you know, he believed in corporal punishment and things like that, you know, and sometimes he would say quite cheerfully to us, well, you know, anyone who does that, I'll be sent to my office and I will beat them. You know, so, not the sort of thing that is possibly expected these days.
Did you suffer this ignominy yourself at all?
Oh, absolutely not, no. But he was a terrifying man. And interestingly, when he died a few years ago, I went to his memorial service in the school chapel, and his deputy, John Holt, gave the eulogy. And I was really, Mr. Holt was quite a frightening man too, but I was interested to know that John Holt turned out to have been quite frightened of him as well.
Was Arnold Kraft a visible presence in the school? Was he sort of out in the corridors and that kind of thing?
Well, put it like this, when he was, you knew about it. I mean, it was, you know, quite a chill. And actually, I'll tell you a story about when I went to Oxford, because Arnold Kraft had a particular connection with University College Oxford. And the reason was that he had been a history teacher at a school in Oxford as his first job.
At Magdalen School, I believe.
Magdalen College School, yes. And when he was at Magdalen College School, his star pupil was a little boy called Leslie Mitchell. And Leslie Mitchell had gone on to become a history don at University College Oxford. In fact, he was the dean of the college. And so when Arnold Kraft wanted to get boys interested in going to Oxford, he'd send them off for a visit to meet Leslie Mitchell, who would show them around, you see. So I was shown around the college by Leslie Mitchell, and then I decided I would like to apply there, and that's where I ended up, although not doing history, you know, but doing English literature instead. But because Leslie Mitchell knew that I had this connection, that we'd had this, you know, the same teacher effectively, he always referred to Peter Arnold Kraft as God. around the college, so in the bar or whatever, he'd say, Michael, have you heard of God recently? Because he found him a very imposing and dominating presence as well, evidently.
I believe he'd been in the RAF during the war. I'm not sure exactly in what capacity, but that had probably also toughened him up too.
Yes, I'm not sure, because he was very, very young. I think he was only 18 in 1944, so I'm not sure whether he actually did any flying or in active service or what. I don't know about that.
Can you tell us also about the atmosphere of the school? Did you enjoy it? Was it a good time for you?
It was quite good fun. We had a good laugh, and I was quite a successful pupil, so I didn't find anything particularly difficult, so I enjoyed that, and I had some friends, yes, so it was good.
What did you think of the teaching quality? Were the teachers that Arnold Kraft brought in, were they good, did you think?
He brought in some very good ones. He brought in the famous Ken Champion, the math master, who had been working with him at another school, I think at Gravesend previously. And Ken Champion was a brilliant math teacher, and the previous math teachers had been hopeless. Well, at least one of them was a drinker. So yeah, he sharpened up the maths teaching very much. Some of the other teachers, the quality I have to say was a bit mixed, but we had enough good ones. Another very inspiring one was Don Hayes, who was the English teacher.
Yeah,
and Don Hayes was the classic inspiring English teacher who could just talk about anything. And as somebody once said to me, he would start off telling you about Lindisfarne, the history of the island off the coast of Northumberland, and then he would start talking about Lindisfarne, the folk band. And he seemed to have endless knowledge of popular culture, serious culture, music, art, history, drinking, whatever it was, you know, he could talk about it and get you interested. So just exactly the sort of person to inspire you to get interested in the arts, really.
So a kind of Dead Poets Society situation.
Yeah, yeah, it was a bit like that, yes.
And I believe the other big character of the time on the art side was Ian Preston doing school shows. Were you involved in those at all?
I was, but it was actually because Jake used to do more popular ones like Pantos and things like that, some of which were uproariously successful. Mm. I was in the more serious school play directed by Don Hayes, which was The Tempest by Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And actually, Jake Preston had a role in the play. He was one of the noblemen who was shipwrecked on Prospero's Island.
Yeah.
But it was a very good play. Yeah, we did well, I think.
And at this time, there were still the boarders at the school. Is that correct?
Oh yeah.
So was there like a division between the day boys and the boarders, or did you all mix together? How did that work out?
Well, it was very funny. We had I think 7 boarders in a class of 30 boys, but the school rules said school uniform, you wore a white shirt or a grey shirt. But rule number 2 was boarders must always wear a grey shirt. Right? I think that was because it wouldn't show the dirt as much. You know, they only changed it once a week or something. So boarders wore grey shirts, and of course, therefore, we always wore the white shirts.
Yeah, yeah.
All the day boys wore white shirts, and all the boarders wore grey shirts. So you could tell immediately who was who. You know, and of course, they were eating school meals 3 times a day, so we felt a bit sorry for them.
What was the food like?
Terrible. When we started out in the first year, the kitchen hadn't been modernised, and you sat at a long trestle table like something out of Charles Dickens, and there was a great cauldron at the end of the table, and the prefect would ladle out some kind of stew onto your plate, and it was passed down the line, sort of thing, you know, and the food was appalling. So it did improve.
But to go back to the boarders, was there a sort of division between the mixing of the boarders and the day boys?
Well, we didn't socialise with them a lot, I have to say. And they were, you know, they tended to be at the bottom of the class, or was another thing, because they weren't, you know, selected for academic ability. Yeah. So generally speaking, they were always in the bottom half, or sometimes the bottom quarter of the class.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was, and Arnold Kraft told me this himself when I was older and I knew him a bit better, he said that when he came to the school, the boarders generally didn't get a single O-level or GCSE or whatever, you know, and by the time, you know, a few years had gone by, they were all getting 8 passes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he said, it's simply a question of raising expectations and saying, you're going to do this, you're going to work and you're going to, you know, be taught properly and all that sort of thing. And certainly, by the time we got to the end of the, you know, when I was in the sixth form, at least one of the boarders went to Oxford University when I did, and another one became a professor of psychiatry.
Well, that's not bad, is it?
You know, they all found their way in the end. Yeah.
Well, that just shows if you set up the right sort of framework, what can be achieved, doesn't it? And so, did you become a prefect yourself? Did Arnold Kraft give you a glass of sherry on Friday afternoons and all that kind of stuff?
I never got the glass of sherry, but I think I was a bit of a favourite of his, but I wasn't considered head boy material, but right. I was the head boy's best mate, you see. So,
very interesting.
Can I just ask, we're probably going to wrap it up now, Michael, but can I just ask one question? You said before about, you know, you did have a good few laughs and stuff. Have you got any kind of anecdotes about, you know, funny stories or anything?
Well, oh yes, where shall I begin? Well, of course, there's a legendary art teacher, Roddy Jameson, who was very eccentric. And Mr. Jameson, I think his wife chucked him out. Mm-hmm. And his solution was that he was going to live in his car parked in the school car park. And this became something of a tourist attraction, because if you walked past at the right moment, you saw Mr. Jameson sitting in the front seat changing his socks in the morning and things like that. You know. he was a very eccentric figure, and not particularly the brightest, you know, art teacher, you might say, but people were very fond of him.
Yeah, sounds so like a bit of a hippie. How long did he live in the car for then?
I don't know. I think it was probably a term or something like that. And the other character that stands out is Pete Still, who was the economics teacher, and even the other teacher thought it was very funny because he was very, very scouse.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the teachers were quite posh, and some of them were quite scouse, and most of the boys were quite scouse as well, I suppose. But we all thought Mr. Still's scouseness was quite something. And the aforementioned Mr. Holt, who was director of studies and so forth, was once overheard saying to Pete Still, could you give me a breakdown of the advanced level economics mock examination results? To which Pete Still just replied, they were crap.
I think from what you say, and from my kind of sort of contemporary age of yours as well, that this was still the age where there were plenty of characters amongst the teaching staff.
Oh yes, there were some, but Pete Still was one of the younger ones, but he was considered to be, you know, even the other teachers found him hilarious because of his his blunt scouse approach. Yeah.
Any other jolly japes or amusing incidents that spring to mind?
I don't know really. We were kept, you know, under Arnold Crabb wasn't going to tolerate anything uproarious. I think it was fairly sort of direct, but we had a good laugh. We found it very amusing. We had a bit of a laugh most days. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Okay, I think that's about it. Chris, have you got anything further you want to add?
No, that's great. That was really great, Mike. Thank you very much.
Very fluent
and
entertaining. Happy
days.
Thank you.
I do have some very happy memories, yes.
Yeah, it sounds it. It sounds great.
Okay,
actually,
then.
Can I mention one thing?
Yeah, sure.
This involves when I first came to the school and I was being interviewed by Arnold Kraft, right? And I was 11 years old, and this was 1970, and my mum and dad were there with me. And my mother's idea at that time was that you had to go to a school where they had short haircuts because, you know, at the time with the 60s,
what
boys wanted to have like shoulder length hair.
Yeah.
And a lot of parents thought this was the end of civilization. So my mother's question to the headmaster of her son's prospective new school was, what's the policy on haircuts? And Arnold Kraft said, oh, well, Mrs. Derriaz, you know, we had a boy here, and he grew his hair shoulder length, and I told him to cut it, and he wouldn't, and I told him again, and he refused, and it became a matter of discipline and, you know, all this sort of thing. And in the end, I expelled him.
Wow.
And my mum thought, ooh, yeah. And he said, very sad, very bright boy, could have gone to university, and now he's working as a lumberjack in Delamere Forest. And my mum said, oh, and then Arnold Kraft said, and I have decided, Mrs. Derriaz, I am never going to do that again. What a waste. You know, this boy, you know, he could have been anything, and now he's working as a lumberjack, all because he wouldn't have his hair cut. It's ridiculous. I am never going to do that again. And my mother was horrified.
Horrified at the idea that he wouldn't have been expelled.
Yeah. And she said to me, oh, very strange man, that headmaster. And I said, oh, well, I think he's very good, Mum.
The generation gap opens.
I never grew my hair shoulder length. But at the same time, you know, I respected, and we all did, the fact that he had the intelligence to understand what was really important.
Mm.
And I'll just tell you one more thing about Arnold Kraft. Again,
yeah, sure.
This is a favourite anecdote. Some of the teachers, as I said, were not great, and some of them were very good. Some of the ones he had tried to sort of force out, and he hadn't been able to. There was a boy in my class called Kevin Whittaker, and Kevin got into trouble for not doing any work when he was about 16. He was hauled in front of Arnold Kraft, who went through every single subject and demanded to know why his performance was lacking. He said, well, why have you failed in geography, Whittaker? And why is your math so weak, Whittaker? And he went through it all and all of this. When they got to physics, he said, why is your physics letting you down, Whittaker? And Whittaker said, it's Mr. X, sir, he can't teach. And Arnold Kraft stared at him and said, I know that, Whittaker. And you know that. And we'll leave it at that. History, why are you so bad?
Very good, very good.
And the story got around, but we respected him for it, you see.
Yeah.
I believe that at this time there was no exam to get into the school, even though there was a kind of, it was essentially still a grammar school. It was all done by interview with Arnold Kraft, is that correct?
Yeah, it was, indeed, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the belief goes that this was as much so he could look over the parents as the students.
Well, it was a bit like that, but there was a famous story, a friend of mine, his little brother, and it was Di Davis, who was very Welsh, who did the interview. He said, oh boy, your mother buys a cake, she cut it in half, and then she cut it in half again, she cut it in half again. How many pieces of cake? And the little boy said, my mum doesn't buy cakes.
Oh.
She makes her own.
Well, I think on that note, that's brilliant. Yeah. Thank you very much indeed, Mike.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure
talking
to you.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you, mate. Bye.
Bye for now.
Bye.